I cannot, with exclusive spirit vision, perceive the building in which this narrative is being translated and recorded. A divine counselor from Uversa, who chances to stand by my side, perceives still less of these purely material creations. This would be the differential of spirit level between the local universe and the super universe. We discern how these material structures appear to you by viewing a spirit counterpart presented to our minds by one of our attending energy transformers. This material being is not exactly real to me, a spirit being, but it is, of course, very real and very serviceable to material mortals. There are certain types of beings who are capable of discerning the reality of the creatures of both the spirit and the material worlds. Belonging to this class are the so-called fourth creatures of the Havona Servitals and the fourth creatures of the Conciliators. The angels of time and space are endowed with the ability to discern both spirit and material beings, as also are the ascending mortals, subsequent to deliverance from the life in the flesh. After attainment of the higher spirit levels, the ascenders are able to recognize material, Marantia, and spirit realities. There is also here with me a mighty messenger from Uversa, an ascendant adjuster-fused one-time mortal being, and he perceives you as you are. And at the same time, he visualizes the solitary messenger, the Supernafim, and other celestial beings present. Never in your long ascendancy will you lose the power to recognize your associates of former existences. Always, as you ascend inward in the scale of life, will you retain the ability to recognize and fraternize with the fellow beings of your previous and lower levels of experience. Each new translation or resurrection will add one more group of spirit beings to your vision range without in the least depriving you of the ability to recognize your friends and fellows of former states. That's very comforting to me.
That's why this thing makes so much sense.
Yep.
This is so easy to accept because there's nothing about it that offends me.
In these Marantia motive citations, there are some that appeal more to one than to others. May I read you the ones that I like the best?
Yes, please. Yeah. 556.
Few persons live up to the faith which they really have. Unreasoned fear is a master intellectual fraud practiced upon the evolving mortal soul.
What number?
Two.
Two.
Five. Difficulties may challenge mediocrity and defeat the fearful, but they only stimulate the true children of the Most High. To enjoy privilege without abuse, to have liberty without license, to possess power and steadfastly refuse to use it for self-aggrandizement. These are the marks of high civilization. Blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. Neither do the celestial beings assist the lower being who refuses to act upon his light of truth. Effort does not always produce joy, but there is no happiness without intelligent effort. The weak indulge in resolutions, but the strong act. Life is but a day's work. Do it well. The act is ours. The consequence is God's. The greatest affliction of the cosmos is never to have been afflicted. Mortals only learn wisdom by experiencing tribulation. Stars are best discerned from the lonely isolation of experiential depths, not from the illuminated and ecstatic mountaintops. You cannot perceive spiritual truth until you feelingly experience it, and many truths are not really felt except in adversity. Impatience is a spirit poison. Anger is like a stone hurled into a hornet's nest. Only a poet can discern poetry in the commonplace prose of routine existence. The evolving soul is not made divine by what it does, but by what it strives to do. Death added nothing to the intellectual possession or to the spiritual endowment, but it did add to the experiential status, the consciousness of survival. The destiny of eternity is determined moment by moment by the achievements of the day-by-day living. The acts of today are the destiny of tomorrow. The argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained.
Anytime I start arguing, I think of that.
Yes. I often put those two together. The argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained. One can be technically right as to fact and everlastingly wrong in the truth. Those illuminate each other tremendously.
The pilot that has this written down in his wallet that I know.
Really?
Yeah, and he used it all the time because I stopped an argument with him once. And he is so impressed. He said, "Where'd you get it?" I said, "I can't remember if it was Plato or something." You know, he just wrote it down and he's got it in his wallet. Every time he sees me, he pulls it out and says,
"Right." I know many times.
Said to him, Bill.
Many times in years gone by, I don't write many evaluations of people anymore. But when I did, I would find so much of this blue book seeping in. And I'm sure that the Rancher Foundation, if they ever would look all of my old reports over, could put me in jail for violation of copyright without giving credit. This whole thing we're talking about This is all taking place up here on Jerusalem, on the mansion worlds. I think this takes quite a while to get to Jerusalem. I've thought about it. How long would you want to spend on these mansion worlds, just voluntarily? I think I'd like to spend 100 years or so, at least. Maybe 1,000 years. I'd like to spend 10,000 years on Jerusalem. There's so much to learn. There's a whole great system to explore, to visit, to grow, to learn. Such fascinating things going on up there. Jerusalem itself is a place of such great beauty, just the physical beauty of the structures.
How long does it take for Adam's children to grow up to maturity? Because I can tell you how long I'll spend there. I mean, if their days are three times longer,
I don't know.
Do their children grow three times longer?
I don't know, bud.
Well, I'll be there three times longer. But that ought to be fun.
Why, sure, it'd be fun.
As long as you don't have to worry about diapers, why I'd be.
Well, now, it doesn't say that's true of the Adamites.
They have diapers?
I suspect they do.
Oh, no.
Well, they should have diaper service there.
It's a cinch that they haven't, that when they volunteer for planetary duty, they haven't. These Adamites are not Maranchans. It's only the Marantia food that leaves no ash. Physical food, I think, works up there just like it works down here.
They have a dual circulatory system.
I know, but one half of it is truly physical.
Can't they work on the other half for this particular problem?
I'm
worried. There's so darn much to see up there.
Poor Adrian wearing
out. The super universe and the Paradise of Ona broadcasts are received on Jerusalem in liaison with Salvington and by a technique involving the polar crystal, the sea of glass. In addition to provisions for the reception of these extra Nebadon communications, there are three distinct groups of receiving stations. These separate but tricircular groups of stations are adjusted to the reception of broadcasts from the local worlds, from the constellation headquarters, and from the capital of the local universe. And these broadcasts are automatically displayed so as to be discernible by all types of beings present in the central broadcast amphitheater. Of all preoccupations for an ascending mortal on Jerusalem, none is more engaging and engrossing than that of listening in on the never-ending stream of universe space reports. The Jerusalem Bob broadcast receiving station is encircled by an enormous amphitheater, constructed of scintillating materials largely unknown on Urantia, and seating over 5 billion beings, material and Urantia, besides accommodating innumerable spirit personalities. They're not in space, you know. It is the favorite diversion for all Jerusalem to spend their leisure at the broadcast station, there to learn of the welfare and state of the universe. And this is the only planetary activity which is not slowed down during the recession of light.
Get that popcorn concession, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Do we sleep up there and have to take time off?
I don't think we sleep. I think we rest. We relax. Sleeping, I think, is a unique experience in this life. I think up there we sleep only the sleep of transition or transport. We do lose consciousness, but only on special occasions. I think we slow down, we stop working, we play.
I was going to ask about these broadcasts. If we were not isolated or quarantined because of rebellion, if we were a normal world,
yes,
and had a normal planetary prince and a normal material son and daughter, and we were in circuit, would mortals be able to hear any broadcasts?
No, but the superhuman beings would.
But the atoms would.
Yes. And what's more,
they could tell us.
They can't broadcast about our world up here, because they can't get to us with their circuits. There are 36 worlds that won't be mentioned. 7?
We that won't have be an archangel circuit.
That's right. They wouldn't use that for broadcasting.
That's strictly top secret.
That's
material.
Right. Mm-hmm. See, they have no coaxial cable going down here. They've only got a telegraph wire. There are 37 worlds that won't be in these broadcasts. They're the isolated worlds. But they're still... That still leaves almost 600 worlds.
Don't you imagine on a normal world that the atoms present, of course, would publish books of some of these items that we could go and see?
I thought about this at length. Even if we could hear and we couldn't understand their language, they'd be talking in Jerusalem at least, the Satanian language, or Nebadan language, possibly.
Well, you mean we could hear, even though...
Well, it'd sound like Chinese, probably.
Maybe we could learn the language.
Well, they would in the seventh stage of light and life, they teach us the super universe language.
I think when we're settled in light and life and the Urantia temple is here, then I suspect mortals do get some of these broadcasts. And they do learn the system language while they're still alive here on Earth.
What are the purposes of these isolated planets?
There were the 37 planets that threw in their lot with Lucifer at the time of the rebellion. And they're not isolated in terms of God, but they are isolated in terms of these communication circuits, reflectivity circuits, and so forth. And it doesn't make much difference to the people, but it makes an awful lot of difference to the superhuman administrators, because a lot of things they're used to are dead down here. The circuits are here, but there's no juice flowing.
They're giving extra help to those people, aren't they?
I just think they have to rise to the challenge. For example, super universe administrators down here would be used to having the reflective services of the Sekhanafim. I think they can bring Sekhanafim down here, but I'm not so sure that they can do any reflecting down here. That circuit is non-operative here.
Bill, now Satania, when Lucifer went into rebellion, Satania was disencircuited from the constellation.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you say 37 planets are isolated.
Mm-hmm.
There are 619. That means that there's some that have gotten partially back in, but they're still not in full standing in the constellation yet.
I think the circuits were restored when Lanaforge took over. They didn't penalize the loyal worlds of the system. Mm-hmm. They threw the whole system out of circuit. You see, it forced everything to be done by Pony Express. The rebellion couldn't spread by wireless. It could only spread if they send a messenger. This planet could communicate with Jerusalem, but it had to all be done by Seraphim, by personal message carrying. After the ascension of Jesus, he transferred the divisional headquarters of the archangels in Satania from Jerusalem to Urantia, and they brought their circuit with them. So we do have a communication line out of this planet now.
Could it be like carrier pigeons?
Yeah, be like carrier pigeons, exactly, yes. The wires are down, we'll send pigeons.
What would happen if the Lucifer Rebellion was adjudicated tomorrow, let's say? And the Most Highs of the
I don't think we would.
Back in.
I don't think we would know any different. But starting with secondary midwares on up, it would make a tremendous difference to this world. It wouldn't make any difference to human beings. Our narrative of these residential and administrative areas takes no account of the vast and beautiful estates of the material sons of God, the permanent citizens of Jerusalem. Neither do we mention numerous other fascinating orders of spirit and near-spirit creatures. For example, Jerusalem enjoys the efficient services of the Spiranga of design for system function. These beings are devoted to spiritual ministry in behalf of the supernatural residents and visitors. They are a wonderful group of intelligent and beautiful beings who are the transition servants of the higher Marantia creatures and of the Marantia helpers, who labor for the upkeep and embellishment of all Marantia creations. They are on Jerusalem what the Midway creatures are on Urantia. Midway helpers functioning between the material and the spiritual. The system capitals are unique in that they are the only worlds which exhibit well nigh perfectly all three phases of universe existence, the material, the Marantial, and the spiritual. Whether you are a material Marantia or spirit personality, you will feel at home on Jerusalem. As so also do the combined beings, such as the midway creatures and the material sons. Jerusalem has great buildings of both material and Marantia types, while the embellishment of the purely spiritual zones is no less exquisite and replete. If I only had words to tell you of the Marantia counterparts of the marvelous physical equipment of Jerusalem, if I could only go on to portray the sublime grandeur and exquisite perfection of the spiritual appointments of this headquarters world, your most imaginative concept of perfection of beauty and repleteness of appointment would hardly approach these grandeurs. And Jerusalem is but the first step on the way to the supernal perfection of paradise beauty. I think, Betty, they tell us so much about Jerusalem, so much more than anywhere else, because there's more to talk about. Jerusalem is just as physical as it is Marantial and spiritual.
You think it perhaps it's because we spend more time there?
No. It's simply because there are more words in Bantu that fit what's on Jerusalem. We can understand anything physical, just about. And this whole thing is the story of the physical aspect of Jerusalem. When you get to Salvington, they don't tell very much, because Salvington isn't very physical. The world is, yes, but the structures are spiritual.
I think we'll spend less time on the system level.
Yes. On Jerusalem, there are many circles, and it's an interesting concept of structure. There are concentric circles, seven, and the highest. They're devoted to certain orders of beings, like the sons of God, the angels, and always the higher orders are in the lower, centermost circles, observable by the lower orders, who thus enjoy privacy, as concerns being observed by their seniors. So that the lowest order admissible to live there. These are apartment houses, so to speak. The lowest orders are in the highest level, at the periphery, and the highest orders are centermost in the lower levels.
Great being inhabited, figured around how it right.
Roll. Let's read about the circles of the finaliters. They're the circles of the sons of God, of the angels and higher spirits, of the universe aids, of the master physical controllers. There are circles assigned to the ascending mortals, including the midway creatures, the circles of the courtesy colonies, and then the circles of the finaliters. These circles have a unique structure at the center. And this same vacant temple is found on every system headquarters world throughout Nebadon. This edifice on Jerusalem is sealed with the insignia of Michael. And it bears this inscription, undedicated to the seventh stage of spirit, to the eternal assignment. Gabriel placed the seal on this temple of mystery, and none but Michael can or may break the seal of sovereignty affixed by the bright and morning star. Someday you shall look upon this silent temple, even though you may not penetrate its mystery. That's a monument to the future.
Bill, you have a telegram. It's in the kitchen phone.
Okay. At what level, Mr. K?
Well, I was puncturing through the first floor.
Well, we have I think we pretty well I think we've pretty well covered Bud's adventures on Jerusalem. In other words, we have now taken the first step in the paradise career, which is the seven mansion worlds and Jerusalem. Not everybody goes through these seven mansion worlds. Some people from rather advanced spheres wake up on Jerusalem. And then they have to go back and get the mansion world experience as teachers. At least this would be true as long as the mansion worlds continue to function as mansion worlds. Of course, when the whole system is settled in light and life, and when everybody wakes up on Jerusalem, then these mansion worlds will be devoted to other purposes. And then I think we'll understand why they are the satellites of the Phanelator's world.
Long.
Oh, yes. But that's happened, Ruth, because there are local universes who are settled in light and life. The older ones. After all, in 40,000 trillions of years, even Urantia could make a little progress. You visualize the Jerusalem cluster?
57.
Of 57 planets. Well, visualize Jerusalem itself. Jerusalem is about 100 times the size of this world, but without proportional gravity, because it's a made-to-order world, and they can build them pretty big without getting them so darn massive, like Jupiter. And encircling Jerusalem are its seven primary satellites. And encircling each of these satellites are seven moons, all architectural. And the seven mansion worlds are the seven moons of primary satellite number one, which is a world given over to the Phanelators.
Well, maybe check it with me. Maybe my math is right.
And these other clusters of worlds are devoted to other activities. And as we advance through the mansion worlds, we'll get a chance to visit them. So you see, we're primarily concerned with only 8 of the 57 spheres in the Jerusalem cluster, the seven mansion worlds, and Jerusalem itself. We visit them, but they're not study worlds. They're worlds in which other activities are going on. And they tell us a little bit about who lives there. One of these clusters of 8 is for the use of seraphim and the like. It's their system headquarters and so on. So, should we promote Bud to the constellation level?
Have we slipped another tile on the floor this time?
Yes, yes.
That's all.
That's all. He is moving on to the constellation, and we are moving backward in the book. You know, this story is told in reverse. They start with paradise, and the last thing they talk about in this series is an inhabited world. So we're reading the book backwards. Up on the constellation, it's his principal objective to become socialized.
Page
485 is the start of the paper. And this is a big cluster. This is 771 architectural worlds constitutes the administrative headquarters of the constellation of Narlashadek. And now we really get introduced to some foreigners, because 99 other local systems are pouring their ascenders into this constellation.
99,000 worlds.
Yeah, if they're all completed systems. Yeah. In other words, in a constellation, there are 100,000 worlds, and if our constellation is, if our system is a criterion, we've got, say, 60-odd thousand worlds from which ascenders are arriving at constellation headquarters. Some extremely advanced individuals skip the entire system and wake up on the constellation. This is possible. And worlds settle in light and life that have been there a long time.
You'd think they would have diffused.
Yeah, some would. You see, when a world is long settled in light and life, death becomes decreasingly frequent. A higher and higher percentage of the mortals fuse during life. And I can imagine that the final stronghold of snobbery could be exemplified by a discussion in a family. You know, Kathy is very interested in that Jones boy. And Mama says, well, I don't know about the Joneses. You know, they die. This would be a sort of a stigma to have too many deaths in the family. You know, what's with you people? Because the author of that paper says that he has visited no world from which death has disappeared. But he has visited worlds on which death is getting reasonably rare. It's a rather nice thought, isn't it? Well,
Bill, the lifespans on these advanced worlds get upwards of 300 years, so it's easier.
Yes.
You have more time.
But you've also got less pressure.
Yeah.
Less pressure. I think in many ways, a world like ours is a pretty good world. Because we are up against coercive pressure. We are forced to make decisions. This is a pressure planet. And there are many advantages, I believe, to having got hatched out on a world like this. The constellation, yes?
I would like to ask about these people who fuse. They might land on Satania, they might land on the constellation,
yes.
You say.
Yes. Or they might land on Salvington. They might virtually miss the total Maranchi career.
Yes. How low do you think they might land?
On the first mansion world, maybe. I don't know, Ruth.
If they fuse?
Not to stay. They wouldn't have any.
No, but if you land on any mansion world, you always land on the first one.
Yes.
Even if you had work which required doing on the seventh mansion world, you'd still land on the first one and spend 10 days on each mansion world.
Bill?
Stepping up.
Take an individual who has really made these supreme decisions to do the will of the Father, gotten in a very good contact with his adjuster, and fuses while in the flesh. But he hasn't had the parental requirements or the equivalent. If this Jesus had the parental requirements, mm-hmm. He had the equivalent, he raised his family, but mm-hmm. How about Enoch or Elijah? We don't know.
We don't know.
Maybe they didn't. Do they have to go through that?
Sure.
Is there a way?
No, I don't think so.
Still diaper.
Yeah. And there's a penalty. There's a penalty for starting up there too high. You have to spend more time lower down in a teaching capacity. You've missed too much. You've missed the diapers. The job we have to do here is to learn how to live with difficult people. And these difficult people are the Univitatia, who are discussed on page 493. Spiritually, they're alike. Intellectually, they vary as we do. In form, they much resemble the Marantia state of existence. And they are created to function in 70 diverse orders of personality. Each of these orders exhibits 10 major variations of intellectual activity, and each of these varying intellectual types presides over the special training in cultural schools of progressive occupational or practical socialization on some one of the 10 satellites which swing around each of the major Edentia worlds. They've got 70 major worlds, and each of those have 10 satellites. That gives you 770, and Edentia is the last of the spheres. In the various, let's see, the physical endowment of Edentia and its surrounding spheres is well nigh perfect. They could hardly equal the spiritual grandeur of the spheres of Salington, but they far surpass the glories of the training worlds of Jerusalem. The time spent on the 70 training worlds of transition Marantia culture, associated with the Edentia age of mortal ascension, is the most settled period of an ascending mortal's career up to the status of a Penelope. This is really the typical Marantia life. It's the mid-phase. You see, on Jerusalem, you're more physical. On Salvington, you are more spiritual. But here you are a true Marantian. While you are re-keyed each time you pass from one major cultural world to another, you retain the same Marantia body, and there are no periods of personality unconsciousness. Your sojourn on Edentia and its associated spheres will be chiefly occupied with the mastery of group ethics, the secret of pleasant and profitable interrelationships between the various universe and super-universe orders of intelligent personalities. On the Mansion Worlds, you completed the unification of the evolving mortal personality. On the System Capital, you attained Jerusalem citizenship and achieved the willingness to submit the self to the disciplines of group activities and coordinated undertakings. But now, on the Constellation Training Worlds, you are to achieve the real socialization of your evolving Marantia personality. This supernal cultural requirement consists in learning how to, first, live happily and work effectively with 10 diverse fellow Marantians, while 10 such groups are associated in companies of 100 and then federated in corps of 1,000. 2, abide joyfully and cooperate heartily with 10 Univitatia, who, though similar intellectually to Marantia beings, are very different in every other way. And then must you function with this group of 10 as it coordinates with 10 other families, which are in turn confederated into a corps of 1,000 Univitatia. 3, achieve simultaneous adjustment to both fellow Marantians and these host Univitatia. Acquire the ability voluntarily and effectively to cooperate with your own order of beings in close working association with a somewhat dissimilar group of intelligent beings. 4, while thus socially functioning with beings like and unlike yourself, achieve intellectual harmony with and make vocational adjustment to both groups of associates. 5, while attaining satisfactory socialization of the personality on intellectual and vocational levels, further perfect the ability to live in intimate contact with similar and slightly dissimilar beings with ever lessening irritability and ever diminishing resentment. And that means that we are still irritable and we can still hold resentment.
Oh, I thought we'd drop it long before that.
We're only on the second level of linoleum.
We should get that worked out right away.
The reversion directors contribute much to the latter attainment through their group play activities. 6, adjust all of these various socialization techniques to the furtherance of the progressive coordination of the Paradise Ascension career. Augment universe insight by enhancing the ability to grasp the eternal goal meanings concealed within the seemingly insignificant time-space activities. 7, and then climax all of these procedures of multi-socialization with the concurrent enhancement of spiritual insight as it pertains to the augmentation of all phases of personal endowment through group spiritual association and Marantia coordination intellectually, socially, and spiritually. Two moral creatures do not merely double their personal potentials of universe achievement by partnership technique. They more nearly quadruple their attainment and accomplishment possibilities.
Is that only true there?
No, that's true everywhere.
I notice they don't capitalize the unification, no. Because evidently that isn't a proper name or a proper...
Well, they don't capitalize seraphim either.
They don't?
No.
We ought to put that down as one of the points for our organization.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we could read it all.
That's right. You see, organizations are not, don't have supreme value in and of themselves. But still, without the structure of an organization, how are you going to achieve group accomplishment? I think an organization is to the you might say, tissue of religion, what one's skeleton is to one's body. Do you ever stop and think how unpleasant a skeleton is if it shows? And how useless any of us would be without that bone structure? But the place for the skeleton is on the inside, not the outside. The more an organization shows, the uglier it is. The more invisible it is, the more valuable it is. That's my own feeling about an organization. Yeah. The same is true with the steel structure in the building. We usually don't expose that, do we?
Wouldn't it be nice if this book gave us a lineup like this for right here on the ranch? Mm-hmm. Anywhere in the book?
No, they couldn't, because it would work only for now. And if they gave it to us, our successors would be afraid to change it and tinker with it as time required change.
No, I don't feel that way. I tell you how I feel. And we can, but, you know, we can interpret it our way. Ourselves.
Sure you can.
That if there would be in this Urantia book something, 10 points, just the other one instead of 7, that would say in another way what they said here, and then repeat it, you know, on levels, it would give me, because I can only speak for myself, a yardstick and an inducement to try right now to rub off some of the edges. You know, this way, when you think, well, good night, we're way up, where are we now, on the constellation level?
Yeah.
And when you read about resentments and so on, and Judith spoke up, she said, oh, my dear, I thought that would be long since gone. Well, I think it can be gone. I think we can get rid of resentments and that sort of thing right down here on your ranch. And I feel very strongly that many of us are reading this book and saying, uh-oh, there's a long, long track ahead, and we don't have to work on some of these things as diligently as if they, you know, pointed it up, you know, that right here and where you are now. Do you remember in an early paper, Lister Alwood, who had a marvelous memory, he never wrote anything down because, you know, we weren't supposed to, and he didn't. And this was verbal. And he, the quotation was this: where you are is the environment in which to make you what you ought to be. And they didn't have brackets to say that you were going to have up to the constellation and, you know, way up there to do it. In other words, they just made a statement for each mind to take it up and do something about it. And my mind that heard it said to me, well, okay, Dorothy, right here and now, where you are is the environment in which to make you what you ought to be, and by golly, you better get busy and do it.
Dorothy.
And I sense very strongly, I'm still not talking, that there is a feeling, you know, that we don't have to do too darn much about what you call mammalia down here.
Well,
and I think we got to do something to be human pretty darn fast.
I would say that's very dangerous thinking.
What I'm doing?
No.
Not for me.
No. No, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I would say that attitude which you're describing is slothfulness.
Well, we have it, don't we?
And they tell us that slothfulness is one of the few things which can cheat us out of survival.
Procrastination, yeah. That is.
Now, Dorothy, here, I'd like to clear up one point. I don't believe we have so much resentment and irritation in dealing with our own kind. I think that by long before we hit the Univitatia, we've become reasonably civilized among ourselves. But these, let me finish. These Univitatia, I think, are designedly difficult for humans to adjust to. They are designedly foreign, because in teaching, when we learn to live with the Univitatia, we are getting over all feelings of foreignness in dissimilar beings. This is designed to socialize us so we can accommodate to anyone in the universe. I think what they've done, Dorothy, in terms of resentment and irritation, we've taken the high jump pretty well. We're up to 8 feet, and suddenly they put the pole at 16 feet, and we've got to learn how to jump that high now.
But what I'm saying, I'm getting right down here on your ranch because that is where I am. And I am going to use two other words. In this thing that you've just read, in this chapter that you've just read, it's Univitatia in connection with those of us, you know, who are the guests up there. And they told us these seven things we're going to learn. So I'm going to talk just about Urantia and use two words, human and mammalian.
Yes.
And the irritations come about between human and mammalians. And I contend that the more human we can become on Urantia, we will rub off and somewhere approximate these seven things here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only bring myself into this room, and I listen, and I go out of the room, and I feel that the way it sits here, and the way you present it, it's fact, but it isn't necessarily the truth. In other words, what I'm saying, it can happen right here.
I think we should make an effort to cause it to happen.
Yes.
Can I just add one thing? I agree with you, but how many in this room have ever tried to live with a Negro or a Chinese or an Indian? I think it would be a quite similar analogy. How many of us say they're all right in their place?
I've had one experience.
See what I'm developing, Bill?
I had one experience with an East Indian, and he was a chap who, he had 5 degrees, the last one from Ohio State. He was our research director for 10 months, at the end of which we fired him, because he was so alien that he simply could not mesh his gears with anyone in the organization. He's the only technician who ever got fired. And at the end of 10 months, we all agreed, this was unanimous, that this man had to go. He was disrupting our whole organization. He was in process of wrecking it. Now, this was a total failure on our part. And since he was one and we were many, he went. This was a commercial organization, not the Kingdom of God, you understand. He was just too expensive.
But this is right down here on your end.
Yeah. His mind was one of the most alien things I've ever tried to cope with.
We don't have to go into the other races. We find many people of our
own.
They're
putting us into the Univitation to say, live with them.
But Dorothy's speaking about getting ready here.
Yeah, listen.
I'm speaking about that too.
Dorothy's issuing an altar call, and it's quite normal.
No, listen, it's not an altar call. But please could I, because I didn't, Judy says, Dorothy, I know what you're saying, you didn't get your point across. I'm going to try again, and I'm asking for help. No, it's important. I've been in here as much as I can, and I want to be a learn because we're supposed to teach. And if I can be a teacher, I want to be a teacher. I could be a teacher now on certain concepts of the book, you know, and some I am hazy on. It doesn't worry me. But more than that, what I want to learn here is how to be a better human being right on your rancho.
Fine.
And every time that I walk out of this room, and I think maybe I have other people who feel that way, I'd like to feel that there was something added unto me in that mm-hmm. department, coming directly from this book. Because mm-hmm. there's facts and truth in this book, and they suffer from interpretation.
Well,
and I'm not your kid,
if you
because
can,
we all come with our own minds, Bill.
Sure.
Okay.
If you'll let me get Bud to Paradise, then we'll take up as our
okay,
next subject.
Please do that.
Yes,
I would just like to say this brief sentence. So much of that help is in the study of the life of Jesus. I think the practical everyday problems and looking at the apostles helps so much. The character studies of those apostles is very enlightening.
All right.
The way
well,
they
wait a minute.
Overcame resentment.
Are they
so
religion or are they human according to what how Bill uses the two words? What are they?
I think they're becoming human, but they weren't awfully human even at the time that they were left alone by Jesus.
Well, I awful. Think they're very human.
Well, I think they
have
more
I would say,
and if we could all try to be human instead of mammalian. I think we have it like right down here.
I would say that.
In 1959. And then we can learn about the absolutes and go out and
yeah, teach they them. Had a lot of mammalian traits before. Left in.
Well, it's
look
the,
at Edner. Is the problem with these unification, the fact that they will help us get over being mammalian so much as the fact that we're meeting Negroes and Chinese and Buddhists in unification.
We're not that type of skin color. We're certainly
problem.
Too far away.
From our problems.
We're too far away.
We better lick the kindergarten stage first.
Darn
okay.
Right.
Yes.
I feel that very strong.
Well, now there's two ways of looking at this. The Dorothy's got a point, and she's also out of order. It's like Maria Velasco years ago, who got very annoyed with the absolutes and everything. And she felt that if we had the golden rule and the Sermon on the Mount, we'd have it made. And Marie taught English. And I said, fine, Marie. I just want to enjoy the poetry of English. I don't want to know anything about spelling or grammar or punctuation. And she looked at me with horror and she said, I get your point. I think some of these things you have to dig out for yourselves. You have to distill your own philosophy of living. I can't give you mine. I can describe it, but it's not yours. And if you just accept it because it's mine, you've accepted a stereotype, which is a plan for action which you accept without validation. You've got to work out your own idea system, I believe. Now, we happen to be approaching this book intellectually right now. This is a class, not a church. You've asked me to help you with some of the concepts in the book. Now, if we want to get down to the principles of living, we'll discuss that, but we're halfway on the way to paradise with Bud. This book gives just two principles of living. This book defines the keys of the kingdom as sincerity, sincerity, and more sincerity. And if you waited just a little bit, we would have been to that quote in about 15 minutes, but we'll hit it now.
I've heard the quote many
times.
Sure.
But if you are failing to act on your light of truth, you're insincere. This is worse than having no guts. If you know better and don't do better, this is the height of insincerity. Now, if you're sincere, the next thing you need is decisions. Decisions and more decisions. And if your decisions are wrong and you are sincere, you're at least in motion. You're in process of learning. And your bad judgment will become good judgment through sad experience.
We don't have time enough, though, for making mistakes, Bill. We can know all these absolutes, and I'm going to learn them. But we still have to be, if we're going to teach, we're going to have to know this other part, too, aren't we?
Well, certainly.
Okay.
We're starting with part one. We're proceeding at the present rate. I dare say we'll be in part four 2 years from now.
Oh, brother, what can happen in 2 years?
Well, I'm sorry.
Bill, can I just say one thing?
Right.
When I look at the flyleaf of the first paper, everybody turn to that, if they will. The flyleaf of the first paper. And there's a lot of absolutes between here and the Jesus papers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it says, the central and super universes, sponsored by a universal core of super universe personalities, acting by the authority of the Orvantan Ancients of Days. Now that never meant anything to me because I never knew who the Orvantan Ancients of Days were. But after reading this book, I find out they represent the Paradise Trinity. And the Paradise Trinity, to me, is as close to any part of the boss I can get. And if the boss figures to give authority to these Ancients of Days to sponsor these papers, I'm going to learn them. That's my whole reason for learning the absolutes. I don't know if it's valid, but I think it makes sense.
May I say that this teaching of English reminds me of my own liking in teaching English is to insist on some of the structural aspects. I just love diagram sentences. I see a beauty in the structure of language.
Beautiful.
And
I see it as an assignment.
But I know, but that's just it.
Yes.
But some people have no earthly use for that and seem to be terribly impatient with any of it, with just any of it. And of course, the whole school system did for a long time, gave no value to it, and wanted only the immediate use of it. You can drive an automobile, certainly, without knowing the names of all the parts. You can drive it very well. But if you want to try to fix it when it breaks down, you have to know something about the workings of it, so that is my argument. But it's easy to emphasize structure. Well, for some people, the resentment in trying to learn the structure is strong, and for other people, it isn't. And I just hope we can all be patient with the possibility of different likings in the amount of structure that is helpful.
It isn't that I don't like structure, I do. And this analogy that you just made is very good. You want to, after you know all the parts of the automobile, you might not be able to fix it.
Yeah,
but one thing you do want to do, you want to be able to drive that automobile intelligently.
And I think I lost a little sight.
So what I'm saying, the thing I'm pleading for, just for myself, is I want to drive the automobile. I want to, after I have this person, I don't want to wait 2 years until I can get down to what Bill says we would eventually get to. I wonder if there couldn't be some correlation between structure and then the fact that we're going to have to drive the automobile, you know, work with this book within the next 2 years and be effective with it in a human sort of way and not mammalian.
Oh, big problem.
Is there a teaching division of the society?
Well, I feel it.
We've got to be human,
just about as good grade humans as we can be.
Right, to the educational division and suggest that they give us something to
it's a roving report.
I know one thing they'll say, they're working out. The Committee on Education is working awfully hard just to get started in the school. They're working at it, but haven't yet got to the place where they can send out to societies helpful outlines for studying the inspirational part.
Maybe
learning to drive. No, we just haven't got there yet.
Maybe Dorothy could send in some ideas.
Yeah, fine. You'd be most welcome.
Julia?
I feel that perhaps in my own experience in teaching, I learn by teaching. I really learned beautiful poetry, not when I took it in school in the third grade and fifth and eighth, but when I taught it. Wow. And all the wonderful history I didn't learn when I was in school. I learned it when I taught it.
Can I read something to answer our argument?
It's no argument.
No, it's no argument, but
the human mind would ordinarily crave to approach the cosmic philosophy portrayed in these revelations by proceeding from the simple and the final.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about this big blue book. And then, if you'd like, we can discuss whatever parts of it you'd like to talk about. I found this book a fascinating publication. I've known about it for over 20 years, and I've read it many, many times. And I'd like to tell you what it means to me. For the first time in my explorations of things philosophical, metaphysical, cosmological, religious, scientific, I find a story in which there's no conflict between science and religion, and where philosophy is accorded its proper place as a mediator between them. I find an intriguing story which stimulates faith on the one hand and stimulates common sense on the other. This book looks pretty esoteric as you look at it. Believe me, it's not esoteric, it is exoteric. And I use these terms in the old Pythagorean sense. You were an exoteric before you became an esoteric. This book is not for an inner circle. This book is for every Tom, Dick, and Harry that's interested in reading it. Far from being mysterious or mystical, it's one of the most down-to-earth tales I've ever read. The only way I know of testing truth is to try to live it. It's the only known proof for truth. You can live this book. You can live this book without being a fool. You can live this book without wearing sackcloth and ashes. You can live this book as a very practical citizen, a useful citizen. In fact, a more interesting citizen than otherwise. We're talking about where we are and where God is, and I was reminded that the use of the Greek alphabet short circuits all of the terms in this book. This book teaches me that I live on a place which we might call Alpha, and there are many of these alphas, many worlds on which people evolve as they evolved on this world. This book teaches me that God, deity, is situated at a point which we will call Omega, and it's at the center of all things. Now, we can imagine what another inhabited world would be like. That's not too tough. We could make it larger, smaller, hotter, colder. We could change the electrical potential. But Beta is, of course, the point of greatest interest. Where do we go when we leave here? This book instructs me that Jesus was speaking quite literally when he said, "In my Father's house are many mansions." And these mansion worlds are what I mean when I refer to Point Beta, the place we go when we leave here, when we graduate from here, in other words, when we die. This book teaches that death is a form of graduation. When we get to Point Beta, we're not exactly material. And we certainly aren't spiritual. I'm so relieved at the thought that I won't be catapulted by the alchemy of death into a state of absolute blessedness. Because if I woke up a perfect being, it would take God himself all of future eternity to convince me it was me. And incidentally, I would feel rather badly gypped out of all the thrilling experience of growth. When I wake up in Point Beta, I shall be comfortably near material, not quite. Paul spoke of this when he said, "In heaven they have a better substance." And this better substance could be described as an emulsion of matter and spirit. Oil and water will mix in the presence of soap, and we call that an emulsion. This better substance is matter emulsified with spirit. Mostly matter at the start, very little spirit. Mostly spirit at the end, very little matter. I'm told that at Point Beta, it's sort of like an incubator for premature children. Because most of us die with too much unfinished business. And we wake up over there with all of this unfinished business to complete. The book interestingly defines the cardinal sins of mankind, not, let's say, as sexual immorality, but as, and this is much worse, equivocation, procrastination, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease seeking. These are mammalian traits. They are subhuman holdovers, indicating that we are still entirely too mammalian and hardly adequately human. Point Beta is devoted mostly to completing the de-animalizing of folks like us. When we graduate from Beta, we will be, honest to goodness, human beings. We will be completely de-animalized. On our next step, Gamma, I'm going to run out of Greek alphabet pretty soon. That's not important. On our next step, Gamma, they unify us. We emerge from this level with a unified purpose for living. This means an ending of the civil war that goes on inside of most human beings from birth through death. We're not perfect beings, but we are mobilized beings. And even then they don't try to spiritualize us seriously, although we're growing spiritward all along. Then they try to socialize us. They teach us ethics. They teach us the quintessence of ethics. We learn how to live with very difficult people. Not difficult because they're mean, but difficult because they are so tremendously different from us. They are designedly different. And when we have learned to live with these folks, who are the native creatures of Point Delta, we can live with about anyone. We not only have developed ethics, but we have developed excellence of technique in making ethical adjustments. And now, when they've de-animalized us, unified us internally, and socialized us, then at the next level they set out seriously to spiritualize us. And when we graduate from that level, we are first stage spirit beings. This book tells us then that of all things we begin the study of the physical universe. In other words, we really study physics and chemistry and the constitution of matter. I was rather shocked when I read that the first time, but then it occurred to me, well, how sensible. As long as I'm a material being, how can I study the material universe? But once I'm not a material being anymore, I'm outside of the material universe, now I can see it, now I can study. When we've completed that, then they tell us that we grow philosophically. Our next step is a very long one, and it involves a great growth intellectually, a growth in the comprehension of meanings. And lastly, at the next level, we complete our time-space growth in values. I would say that it's at this point we graduate from the university of time and space. And for all I know, we may have to stand an oral exam in connection with acquiring our PhD or our official tickets. And we're pretty big people now because we've graduated from this university. But the next step is we matriculate as freshmen in the University of Eternity. Then they tell us we really learn what study, true study, means. This is an adventure. All the way along, we're not just pupils, we're also teaching. They tell us that to pass a course, we must pass the most difficult examination that could possibly be contrived. We're not given a passing grade until we have demonstrated our ability and our willingness to teach that course to our juniors following along behind us. And anyone who is taught will, I know, realize that teaching is much tougher than passing an examination. Somewhere in our progress through the University of Eternity, at one of the levels in there, and there are seven of them, we move in as a visitor to Omega, to become acquainted with God. And when we have finished our course in the University of Eternity, we spend some time at Point of Meeting. And then we are commissioned, and I'll use the word eterneliter to indicate our status. We have embarked upon the eternal service of deity, and we in turn pay out for what we have received. In other words, we participate in the running of this wide-spreading universe of universes, about 1/7 of which we perceive as the Milky Way. That's the most intriguing story told in this big blue book. That story runs all the way through part one and part two of the book. Part three is the history of our world. It starts out with the nebula which gave origin to the sun, and then traces through the birth of our solar system, the geobiologic story of the planetary past, pretty well running parallel with the long calendar of geologists, not the short calendar. Geologists disagree as to how old this planet is. The book tends to validate the longer term estimates. It tells the story of racial evolution on this world, and it's fascinating. The story of the first human family, the story of the first human beings who mutated out of the animal level around 1 million years ago. It explains some paradoxes in archaeology. It explains why the Foxhall people in England are so superior to the Neanderthalers and so much older. The story goes on through the whole million-year history of man on Earth, his ups and his downs. I was terribly surprised to read that Adam and Eve were real people, but they weren't the first people. They arrived about 37,000 years ago, and the human race is 1 million years old. But it tells me why Cain was able to find a wife in the land of Nod. Now, it's rather peculiar. When they edited the Old Testament, they didn't edit quite carefully enough. This book tells the story of later racial evolution. It just about hooks up with where archaeologists have dug back. It tells the story of the evolution of religion in Part 3. That's the longest subdivision in Part 3, starting out with fear and ending with a mixture of fear and love, and in the higher religions, more love than fear. It tells the story of each of the great religions that have lived here on Earth. This book goes on to discuss the modern problems of religion. It discusses not only the past of religion, but the present problems of religion. And then it takes up a very interesting story. There's a whole group of papers which discuss the meaning of that biblical statement that something about the true light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This discusses the indwelling of God. We're taught in this book that God indwells each of us. And incidentally, that concept is found in almost every religion. In the Quran, it says, men search for me afar off, and I'm nigher to him than his own jugular vein. This story of the indwelling of God is one of the most inspiring things in this book. We're not dual people. This is not a person that lives in us. This is a piece of God, just as you would tear off a piece of a newspaper. This is not all of the newspaper, but it's true paper, just like the newspaper. This is what draws us into Point Omega, because this piece that came out from God wants to go back there. And if we have any brains and don't louse up this thing beyond all recognition, we can travel back to Omega with this piece of God.
the relationship of this indwelling spirit is like to us, is like the relationship of a pilot to a captain of a ship. This indwelling spirit knows exactly how to get to Omega. It's going to take a long time. But having come out from there, he knows the road back. And he'll take us there if we as captain will give him permission and authority. The only thing that can stop him from bringing us there is us, our choosing not to go. Parts 1, 2, and 3 are tremendously intriguing stories. Part 4 is the most valuable part of this book. Part 4 is the story of the life and teachings of Jesus. And believe me, it reads like a novel. There are sections in the other parts that are a bit rough going. They're deep concepts. You don't chew them up. They've got to dissolve slowly under the tongue of your intellect. But part 4, for the most part, it's the story of the life of one person. It's the story of the early first century goings-on in the Commonwealth of Israel. It's a story of two people who had children, the first of whom was quite unusual. It's the story of the growth of a little boy, and that's always an interesting story. It's the story of his school years. It's the story of what an interesting pupil he was. He was a walking question mark. It's the story of his ideals and his disappointments and of some of the hubbub he raised around Nazareth because he was a very active person. I think perhaps the most interesting part of that story to me is the story of his early adult life, his adventures, his accomplishments as a young man in his 20s, as he is beginning to acquire that wisdom, marshal that knowledge, and mobilize that experience, which he so eloquently revealed in his public career. There's a piece of advice which he gave a rich Roman senator on the nature of wealth that is the most unique treatise on economics I have ever read in my life. It is not socialistic, it is not capitalistic, it is strictly Jesusonian. You read it and you'll simply chuckle and say, that's so simple, why didn't I think of it myself? But I've never read it anywhere else. And then there's the story of his public life. And so many things are unscrambled, put in place. The story of the 12 apostles, which is the longest single chapter in this book, is one of the most moving tales I've ever read in my life. The story of those 12 men and of the impact which Jesus made on their lives, and on through to the story of the last tragic week in Jerusalem. Gee, there's 5 whole papers here on the Last Supper. I think the thing is reproduced practically verbatim. And then his tragic death, and what ensued after the time of the tomb.